Jeff.
Hello, Soraya. Can you hear me through my gas mask? I'm trying to stay...
I can, surprisingly well.
I'm trying to stay healthy and safe over here in Inland Empire.
I'm stress cleaning, so, you know, we all have our own coping mechanisms.
I think I've washed my hands down. I'm probably down like 10 layers of skin. But
we're all getting down to the nitty and the gritty.
Yes.
With zero gritty.
Exactly.
Woo! Crazy times.
Indeed. But
the show goes on.
The show must go on. At least ours, right? So, I mean, we have less than 50 people in the room, right? And you and I are more than 6 feet apart, so we've got some...
We have appropriate social distancing protocols in place.
We do.
And we're following the governor's mandate that we not gather in spaces with 250 people or more. So, Jeff, our show is, I'm officially declaring it, we are coronavirus compliant.
We are definitely are coronavirus free, coronavirus compliant.
In 20 years, when we hear this, we're going to go, what was the coronavirus?
Exactly.
Anyways.
Exactly.
Enough of that talk. Jeff, talk to us about who our guest is today.
Yeah, so this one we've been talking about, you and I, behind the scenes for about a year and a half. And today we've invited Lisa Fancher, CEO and founder of Frontier Records, a record label that has put out some pretty fantastic records that we talk about on our show, as well as some very influential punk records too. So I'm really excited that it's finally come to the point when we're having her on the show, since we've been talking about this for months. So I say we give her a call.
Let's do it. Hi, this is Soraya.
And this is Jeff.
Our podcast is called Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme.
A podcast where the two of us play music that we like and share anecdotes and background about the tunes.
We hope you'll join our conversation. And without further ado, a groovear.
Let's get groovy. All right, let's add Lisa to the call. Hello, Lisa. This is Jeff and Soraya from Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme. How are you today?
I'm well. How are you guys? Are you self-isolating?
We are indeed. Nice. Yeah. We're staying at least 6 feet apart from each other. We've got Clorox wipes on the microphones. We should
be. What it's all about.
Well, we're so glad to finally have you on the show. Soraya and I have been talking about getting together with you for at least a year and a half, so we're really excited.
Really?
Yeah, so we're really excited.
What was the hitch? What was the delay?
All kinds of things, mostly other things that came up that we had plans for, new releases that prompted other discussions. We had some live shows that we reviewed. All kinds of things. But I have a little introduction. Today, Soraya and I are thrilled to have a very special guest on the podcast, founder and CEO of Frontier Records, Lisa Fancher. And Lisa, again, I wanted to welcome you and thank you for joining Paisley Stage Raspberry and Rhyme today.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So part of the reason why we first started to think about talking to you was back in October of 2018, we spoke to Danny Bonaire from the 3 o'clock on our episodes number 4 and 5, and your name and influence came up multiple times in that conversation, including your role with The Quick and their fan club, Danny's introduction to pretty much every band he was in, Choir Invisible, The Weirdos, Salvation Army, the 3 o'clock, of course. And your label has released several albums that we've discussed on our podcast, including Choir Invisible, the Salvation Army album, Baroque Hoedown, and 16 Tambourines from the 3 o'clock, Native Sons by Long Riders, whew, as well as a bunch of others.
Wow, look at that list. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, you've been a big influence on us. So we knew we had to invite you on the podcast, and today we finally have that opportunity. So we wanted to ask you, Lisa, Frontier Records is celebrating their 40th year this year as a record label. Would you mind talking to us about how you started the label in the first place?
Not at all. I wouldn't mind that one bit. I worked at Bomp Records, which I don't know how old you guys are, if you're familiar with Bomp, but I worked at Bomp for, don't know, a couple of years, and then a couple of years after I started Frontier. But basically, I was really into the hardcore scene. I mean, I was into the earlier punk scene, you know, like the Screamers and the Weirdos, but I just had, you know, I had no money, and there was, like, no chance I could put out a record. But anyway, I wrote for New York Rocker, and I went out, and I saw, like, Red Cross, and I saw the bands that were playing in 79 and 80 out at the Cuckoo's Nest. And I was like, I'm going to put a record out, but I played it for Greg Shaw. He didn't get it or like it, so that was good. I didn't betray my boss. And I was like, darn it, I'm just going to save my pennies, and I'm going to put a record out. So the first record I put out was the Flyboys, and that was a total failure. Also, I should add, they morphed into Choir Invisible in a weird way. And so anyway, I never thought I'd put out another record. To me, it was just like putting out a fanzine or something. It was like something to do. And then the second record I put out was the Circle Jerks group Sex in November 1980. So, yeah, the first record came out in March of 1980, Flyboys, and then the second one was Circle Jerks, and then things changed after that. Then it was a little easier to put out records.
And, Lisa, I wanted to take a step back for a second, and Jeff mentioned your role with the Quicks fan club. We were really
curious.
Yeah. We wanted to know, is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners about running that fan club? That just seemed...
It wasn't really that great. It was, like, just kind of cheesy, but it was super fun. I mean, I think of myself as a writer, even though I've had this label for 40 years. But, so I really, like, you know, I like when I grew up, they had, like, the crazy magazines, you know, Hullabaloo, you know, stuff like that, Teen Beat, all those things. So I would put together, you know, I would do, like, clip art, you know, people doing the twist and things like that, and, you know, write some articles about what they were doing. So it was fun for me to do. There wasn't a ton of issues, and the band wasn't even around that long. But, you know, I wouldn't call them super celebrities. I don't know if you guys know who Dennis Cooper, the author, is. There was pretty cool local people that hadn't gone on their career path yet. And, of course, Camel was in the thing. Danny and I knew Mark socially before Star Wars even came out. So he was... by far and away our most famous member, but, you know, there was, I gotta say, I don't know, I think that maybe there was like 200 or 300 people, maybe at the very end of the whole thing, so.
That's still
pretty. You know, they weren't on Mercury that long, so that was how we distributed the Pretty Please 10-inch and the single. We, you know, wrote to everybody and told them it was out, and, yeah, so it was a fun deal. It wasn't a super major time drag for me or anything, so I just did it when I could, when there was some news, and I managed to really, really irritate some of the band too. And the Not Danny portion of the band, you know, they didn't get to see it before it came out, so sometimes I might have shredded some club owners or maybe Rhino Records, who had stolen one of the Quicks covers, and somebody did it anyway. So yeah, I managed to get yelled at a few times too, so it was all worth it.
Sounds like a punk rock success to me.
Yes.
That's right. And you know what? I don't have all those, and it's, you know, I would copy those and the paint box issues for you, but you'd think I would have kept a set of them, but no.
And this was definitely before digital. So you mentioned the paint box fan club. So that was the 3 o'clock fan club.
Yeah, I did that also just because it was fun to do that, and... you know, in my mind, I kept them all in the same place. And, you know, once upon a time, you pasted things up. You know, you used wax or glue or whatever and stuck it on a piece of Xerox paper. I don't, you know, sometimes a finished one will show up in my stuff when I'm looking through it, but I don't know where the originals are. It's just, I know they're here somewhere. I would never throw them away, but haven't opened the right drawer or closet yet. So that would be very exciting when they turn up, because there's a guy named Ryan Richardson in Texas that wants all the Better Boys, which was the Quicks one. And then you guys want the paint box, so it'll be great when they turn up someday.
Yeah, so Soraya and I were both members of the paint box, so we would always look forward to those issues coming out. And we both were card holders in the paint box, so.
Wow, heavy duty. Did you join early enough to get, like, the singles and stuff?
Yeah, so I got the Christmas single and the Lucifer Sam single. I got both of those.
Yeah, it was a Muvin 2 and Lucifer Sam. And that's pretty, I mean, most fan clubs, you don't get a real cool record. I mean, you might get a button or sticker someday, but that was pretty hip that we put out actually spent the money putting out records.
Yeah, that was really...
It was probably my money, but I don't even remember. It was so long ago, I don't even remember who paid for it, but... You know, we didn't press an extraordinary amount of them, but still, it was a pretty neat little bonus.
Yeah, and those are collector's items now.
Yes, I was going to say.
Are they?
They are.
I never looked on Discogs. I should check it out.
Let me tell you, and they go for a pretty penny.
They do?
Yes, ma'am.
Ooh, I just gave some free ones to the kids at Burger. I was selling at this, like, record swap thing, and I found, you know, like a small handful of them, and those guys are big, quick, and as you know, big pop band, so they were very excited when I laid it on them, but I'm going to get them back.
Well, the next time you want to get rid of a couple of, you know, free copies you find floating around, you can call Jeff and I. We'll gladly find our way to you.
Yeah, you can have spares, but now I don't know where those went again. I boxed up all the stuff after the thing, and it went in the garage, so, oh man, I need an archivist. It's crazy.
Jeff, that can be something we can talk to Lisa about later. Lisa,
exactly. Plan your trip around it when we can travel again, whenever that is.
Well, you know, we have hazmat suits, can travel. So
wait, we're good. Yeah. The full Lisa, suit, nice.
I wanted to ask a question because one of the things that perhaps some of our listeners don't know is that Frontier released quite a few seminal punk albums during, including records from, you already mentioned Circle Jerks, but also Adolescence, TSOL, Christian Death, and Suicidal Tendencies, among many others. But obviously, we want to talk to you about a few of the Frontier releases related to the Paisley Underground and some of the Paisley Underground adjacent bands.
Right.
And the first one that we wanted to talk to you about is the 6th release on Frontier, Choir Invisible.
Chances are you've done some favors they intended to repay, then hurried on their way home. It's such a shame, God less than you bargained for. Follow me down.
From 1981, which, as Jeff mentioned...
I didn't even know about that at all because, man, talk about it stiff. I mean, I really liked it a lot, and, you know, I stand behind it even now, but, man, what a... It was just the wrong record at the wrong time. Uh-huh. You know, trying to do, like, some kind of new romantic Ultravox. I don't know what the heck it was, but, you know, everybody got used to the label being what it was. Didn't go over that well, but... Anyway, how did you guys discover it? Did you just see it in the record store, or how did you find out about it?
I found out about it from the connection with Danny Bonaire. So after hearing Baroque Hoedown and trying to find out everything related to the 3 o'clock, I went back and found it that way. So it was...
Oh, so you didn't know about it from way back when. You just kind of just stumbled upon it.
Yes. Right. So Baroque Hoedown was my introduction to Frontier and actually the whole L.A. scene.
Same with me.
That's a pretty good record, and it stands up pretty well, I must say.
Yeah.
And I want to say it came out right before Suicidal, so probably made some punk rockers mad if they probably looked at the cover and went, I do not want to own this.
Yeah.
But I didn't care, because I thought hardcore was pretty picked over by 82, 83, so anyway, I was a big fan of Corsio. Like, I heard the Salvation Army single when I was working at Vinyl Fetish, and I just went, that's the guy for me. I want to put out that guy's records.
Yeah, speaking of that, so a couple years after the Choir Invisible record, originally in 1982, the Your Catalog FLP 1008, the Salvation Army record came out. Did that come about
yes.
as a result of hearing that single?
Absolutely. I wanted to put it out then, but they were on, you know, they were on New Alliance and stuff, so fair enough. But they, anyway, that band did not exist. Johnny Blazing wasn't in the band, all that kind of stuff. So they were quite a different group than, you know, that, I can't remember the drummer's name, Troy. Right. He was in the band. But then they got Lewis, and let's just say they're rough around the edges, and I think we made that record in 2 or 3 days, punky poppy record. And then, I don't know how long it was out, but we got a cease and desist from the actual Salvation Army because they saw their name on a marquee. So that is why we changed it to before 3 o'clock, was because they were going to see the crap out of me, and I was not interested in that sort of a thing.
So did that cease and desist come to you as the label?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. They told me they did not want that record out another second, even though the New Alliance single probably sold a zillion times more than my album did. But they were on Frontier at that moment in time, so I got the letter.
Wow. So
yeah, I think that was a bummer.
I think in 85 was the version that came out where the name was changed to Before 3 O'Clock, I believe.
Yeah, it actually did take a while. They didn't find out about it, you know, the first month it was out. But, you know, it took me some time to turn the jacket around. But, yeah, so.
And that's
so more as the band got more popular.
And then move forward. And then the Yeah. Hoedown? By now, the band's changed their name to the 3 O'Clock.
Yes.
And the release comes not too long after that Salvation Army release. And we're just curious, because you said the New Alliance single had probably sold more copies than the album on Frontier. So then
right.
what did you see was different about how Baroque Hoedown started moving? Because like Jeff and I said, this was our introduction to this LA scene, to the 3 O'Clock, and it seems like Baroque Hoedown had a different momentum behind it.
Yeah, they were, you know, once Lewis hadn't been playing guitar a super long time when he, you know, they made the album. He was just kind of tagged by Michael, and we made the record on the fly. But by the time Baroque Hoedown came out, he was a much more polished guitar player. Of course, Danny was a quote-unquote real drummer. And I can't remember where we even got Mickey. Who knows? I'm sure Danny told you the story. But, you know, Danny and I were massive, massive Sparks fans. They were like, oh, my God, Earl Mickey. Oh, my God, are you kidding me? And so, again, the record probably didn't take more than a week, maybe. It wasn't a full album. It was just a few songs that Michael had written. And it was a whole new sound because, you know, Salvation Army kind of, it was pop punk, but this was certainly had nothing to do with punk rock at all. And the LA scene was just starting to come together with the Paisley Underground. I think the term had been coined, but, you know, there was a lot of bands that were just wearing 60s clothes and had grown their hair out to, you know, so that to differentiate themselves from punk rockers, they had, you know, their form of 60s hairdo they had. And there it was. And, I don't know if that was the very beginning of, I don't know if Rain Parade, you know, I don't pay attention to that. I don't know, was Rain Parade a month earlier? I don't know. Somebody can argue about that. It's like, was it Bad Brains first or was it Middle Class first? I don't know. But anyway, so it was just all coming together with, you know, Green on Red and Dream Syndicate. You know, they were all playing at the same time, playing with each other. They knew each other. You know, some of that contingent lived in Brentwood for, you know, the Susanna Hoffs gang. So it just all sort of fell together. It was fun.
How was your thoughts about the Salvation Army going from a rougher, punkier edge to a more pop psychedelic sound? As a label owner, and knowing the band from the beginning. How did you feel about that change?
I liked both versions of it a whole lot. I mean, I wouldn't say the Salvation Army was, the LP was, I think it fails for a couple of reasons. I don't think Tom Wilson's heart was in it, and the band just wasn't that sharp. But the tunes you can't deny. But I thought Bro Conan was a whole new and exciting sound. So I didn't think they would be popular. I just did it because I did it. Never thought that they would be headlining pretty big venues. Never saw that, you know, I didn't think they'd get signed to a major label or hang around with Prince or any of those things. But, yeah. You know, Michael's a solid songwriter and still is. So someday maybe I'll put out a record for money. But I just thought it was super great and cool. And, you know, we got Ed, who took all the punk rock photos for me, and got him together to take some photos, and there we were.
Nice. And then not too long after that, the band released 16 Tambourines. Which was your Frontier catalog, FLP 1012.
Yeah, and oddly enough, the sandwich is 1010 is Bro Codan, then Suicidal Tendencies, then 16 Tambourines. So what's up with that?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, so 16 Tambourines is a little bit more elaborate. There was, you know, now they're kind of popular, and Michael was putting a lot more effort into the songwriting. Maybe instead of 5 days, maybe it was 2 weeks. I remember he stayed at my house. I had an apartment, and he didn't want to drive back and forth to Torrance. Totally understandable. Or Carson, wherever his parents lived. And then Earl was out in Thousand Oaks, so the whole thing was kind of an ordeal. But, yeah, they spent a lot of time with the overdubs and all the, you know, the strings and the whole thing. So it became a much bigger production. And I thought that record came out amazing. Yes. And then we even had a couple of extra things that we could throw on singles, and yeah.
I have to ask, getting Earl Mankey aboard, was that an easy task?
It was. He's like the nicest person that you've ever met in your entire life. Was not difficult at all. He was, you know, doesn't think of himself, you know, when I think about Sparks, you know, I think about that version of Sparks. And he's just like the nicest person you ever want to meet. And he's just super, you know, nerd, bored, you know, talk about tech gear and guitars and all that. And super friendly and really easy. And, you know, we'll work with your budget and all that. So can't recommend him highly enough. And I'm glad he's still making records. I know he's, I read various members of Permanent Green Light's Instagram, and they're working with their Earl right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so he's still at it, which is awesome.
He's amazing. He's amazing. Mm-hmm. One of these days, we'll be able to sit and talk with him, too, about some of these.
And that was the first place I would be with the 3 o'clock, and, you know, if we were bored, we'd be watching the very earliest of MTV, and we'd be like, what is this? You know, because they had, like, 4 videos they would just repeat into infinity. But Earl had cable, so we'd sit in the living room, and, you know, because it's really hot out there. It's like L.A. hot, only even hotter out there.
So right.
Avail of ourselves of MTV full-time of somebody who's doing vocals. I just wanted to check it out.
Exactly. And I wanted to talk a bit then about, since we're going to go in numerical order, which I love that sequence of Baroque, Suicidal Tendencies, and 16 Tambourines.
Yes.
But,
yes.
I know, it's like, what is going on? Schizophrenia.
But I love the variety. You have a great ability to bring different artists together and get those albums out. So then in 1984, 1013, that's Paisley Underground Adjacent. Those are the Long Riders and Native Sons.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. The Long Riders, Native Sons.
Yeah. tried so hard to explain the way things are, now quick they can change. But you never listen, just turn your head. Have you heard a single word that he said? While it's true now that I'm not a saint, I felt pain when you lived the hate. Said it before and I'll say it again. Leave me alone, man, and treat me like a friend. I had a dream last night. Everybody's laughing and everything was alright. Still some hope in sight. That was last night. I had a dream last night. Nobody's crying, nobody's right. Still some hope in sight. That was last night.
This is a really unique album in the Frontier catalog. And so talk to us a little bit about how this band comes to Frontier at this time and with this record.
Let's see. I don't remember. They were another band. They were just like kind of around and I liked them. Sid was roommates with my then boyfriend. So they had moved out from, none of them were from Los Angeles. They had all moved out from Kentucky or Indiana or whatever. Mm-hmm. And their manager was a friend of mine too, John Guarneri. And they just wanted to do a one-off, and you know, I've done a million one-offs, I knew term. And it was pretty, compared to 3 o'clock, it was pretty expensive endeavor. We did it at A&M Studios, and it didn't take a super long time to make the record, but anyway, it was another cut above kind of thing where we spent real money on it. And because John Guarneri was actually in the music business, he worked at what would be Faulty Products and, you know, the whole IRS Miles mm-hmm. Copeland deal.
Right.
So he just insisted on me passing another hurdle and not so slapdash as my other releases. And that was a good exercise for me. And he was the one that landed Henry Diltz and found him somehow and asked him to do the photos. So.
Wow.
I think it holds up pretty well.
Yes, it's a great
album. Because I love the EP that I later put on the end of the CD. I loved it. The EP right. was great. And I don't know why they didn't do the album with Jim. I don't know if there was some fallout. I don't know what the reasoning was, but there I was.
So did you know when you put out Native Sons that it would be the only Long Riders full-length release that you would be releasing? You said it was a one-off. So you knew right from the get-go it's just...
It was just me because EPs are just, you know, I put out Broco down. EPs are just a total waste of cash. You have all the expenses of an album, and then you have to sell it for like half price. So it's basically just, I wouldn't call it a waste of time necessarily, but I'd rather make my money back, mm-hmm. if not more than my money back. So, they had enough songs for a whole album, so... I don't think it was even a question whether we would do an EP or an LP. It was just like, I just said that that's what I needed for a one-off, and they were like, okay, cool.
I've never thought of that from a production standpoint, but that makes perfect sense that the costs are the same for a 12-inch
EP. Yeah, the album jacket, the whole, all the stuff is the same as an LP. Yeah, you might spend a little bit longer in the studio, but, you just can't, obviously you can't sell an EP for a full price, or that would be very rude.
Right. Well, the last release that
we even made a music video. I don't know. I'm sure it's on YouTube. I don't know if you saw the video we made, but we used a local guy named Bill Fishman that went on to make a couple of, I don't want to use the word cheesy, a couple of low-budget movies, tape heads and some other stuff. Anyway, we used him to make a music video, and it worked out pretty well.
So I think that probably led to the Long Riders getting the beer commercial, probably. I would imagine that Miller beer commercial that they ended up doing.
Yeah, I don't know how that came about because, I think that they were working on that. You know, the minute they went over to England, they just became super popular, and then I didn't, I wasn't really privy to it. But I would say maybe they got discovered that way.
Yeah, for sure. So the last release, specific release that we wanted to mention on mm-hmm. our podcast was Born Innocent, recorded by a few young boys from Hawthorne, California, not the Beach Boys.
I know, the greatest.
Yes, we're big Red Cross band.
In the Exorcist, baby, you were really insane. Got fun.
that was eventually released under the Frontier Catalog FLP 1018, and it was originally released on Smoke 7 Records in 1982. What was the decision for Frontier to re-release that?
I just always loved Red Cross. The second I heard them, when I saw them down in Costa Mesa and many other shows, I was just a super duper duper fan of theirs. I just thought they were the greatest thing in the whole world. And I'm talking about the version that had Greg Hetson, the brothers, I don't even know who was playing drums. And Steve would have to stand outside because he was so little, like they wouldn't even let him in the club. Like he could be on stage long enough to play. And then they'd be like, open the door and like, get out. So I would just talk to him outside and everything. It was pretty remarkable. He had a girlfriend that was old, you know, kind of older than him. She's like part of the Germs gang. So the whole thing was very intriguing. But Smoke 7 went out of business, so he was just looking to sell the whole catalog. But honestly, I didn't really think that his other records were that great. But Born Innocent was a definite because I thought it was great. But what was really depressing recently, Red Cross, somebody's making a documentary about him.
Yes.
His name's Andrew. And so they told the story that I had rejected the demos for that. Because I thought it was crappy, and I don't even remember that they had ever offered him to me, because I would never say no to Red Cross, like ever, I would never. And what I think happened was I just had a bottleneck of releases coming out, and I probably asked them to wait, or I ran out of money, but I would certainly never say no to the Red Crosses.
No,
I love those guys.
They're amazing. Still do. Yes, they're still putting out amazing records.
They played a great show for Janet's... you know, if you gave money to donate to Janet's healthcare bill, then you got to see Red Cross play. It wasn't a private show, but anyway, you know, the only way you could get in was if you donated money to her. And they were so amazing to see them in a pretty small nightclub again.
Wow. Yeah, that took place last year. I recall that happening.
Yes. Cool. So I brought her a box of Born Innocent to sign for the kids. So hopefully they sold them for another ton of money to have them autographed by whoever was in, you know. Three of the people that played on there anyway.
Lisa's got a house full of magic boxes, Jeff.
Yes.
Born Innocent.
I sure do. And they reproduce, and then I find it, and I go, I didn't know I had this or whatever. So
call us next time. Do me that thing.
That's right. Archivist.
There you go. Lisa, we wanted to switch gears just a little to ask you about the label in a general sense. I mean...
Okay.
Really impressive because your Frontier is celebrating 40 years of releasing great music. And Jeff and I just have a very simple question. How does Frontier, how did the label withstand the test of time? 40 years of
significant. I think I'm just stubborn and probably not very smart because any other person probably would have thrown in the towel and sold it to somebody else a long time ago. But if I had to, I would just drop back and whatever I had to do to cut corners or, you know, I never had a lot of employees, but sometimes I had offices and a few employees, and other times when the economy was bad, I would just cut back to a couple people. Now, I've worked out of my house for many years since the 90s. You know, like the music business obviously just keeps contracting, so...
Right.
And, for instance, last year, I don't even know why, but last year we didn't even put out any records. I don't know why. It just happened. And then this year I'm putting out a bunch. Not sure how I'll pay for them, but, you know, Rainbow closed. And that was hell finding a new pressing plant and moving all my stuff across the country. And now the people that make lacquers caught on fire, so now you can't get a lacquer to save your life. So
it's
interesting, that's for sure.
That makes it challenging for a record label to get anything pressed.
Yeah, it really does. You just have to be able to be a little bit nimble and, I never put out, Berger just amazes me because those guys work so hard. It was like, I never wanted to work that hard where I put out, you know, 20 or 30 records a month. They're like, I think the most I ever put out was 5. And even then it was usually 2. Okay. Cause there's just not that many good bands out there in my opinion. So, but anyway, we could just cut back. I'm the only person that's really essential to it, and even then, I'm not that. My employee, Julie, that's worked for me for many, many, many years, knows where it's at and does all the production and everything. I'm really not that useful. I could go get a job, but I don't want to.
Well, I just hope that you just keep putting out music. That's all I hope.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you stand on the Lilies topic, but I've been reissuing the Lilies albums, and I'm very proud of those. Those are early 90s shoegaze type stuff, but really incredible songwriting and really good records. So I'm slowly putting out one after the next, and then the other ones are on major labels. I don't know if I'll ever get my mitts on those, but anyway, they're really great records. So I've been working with Kurt for the last 2-3 years. And, yeah, just seeing whatever, you know, I'm still trying to reissue punk rock so I can pay my bills, putting out old punk rock records itself. So I got a few irons in the fire in that topic and stuff. And then this year we're doing, obviously, our 40th anniversary shows. I hope all this coronavirus goes away because we have a couple of really cool shows planned at the end of the year. We'll have, like, a pop night with, you know, the bands that aren't punk, obviously. Wow. I will certainly ask at 3 o'clock. They don't play that much, but it'd be nice if they could play a short set. And then punk rock night, obviously, would be the Adolescents, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth.
Well, I hope that happens. I would love to be able to attend those shows. Well, you were talking about reissues, and I have to sneak this in. Sorry, Soraya. This is just
No worries.
This is just between this is between Lisa and I, because this is one of my favorite bands. Yeah. It's a little outside of our wheelhouse, but it's related. So, Lisa, one of the bands that you've put out, there have been some recent reissues from the band, and it started with me with the 1985 release, Exploring the Axis. So the band, Thin White Rope, one of my all-time favorite bands. So you put out Exploring the Axis, that was the catalog FLP 1015, and Frontier went on to release several albums from the band, and they were from Davis, California, I believe, and the Dream Syndicate's Steve Wynn and Kendra Smith were also from the area, so there's a connection, but can you tell me anything about the band and putting out those releases, because I'm a huge fan of Thin White Rope.
I believe... I can't remember who gave it to me. I believe I heard a demo tape by them, because normally I would just see somebody at a club and then I would like them that way, or maybe Rodney played it. That was certainly not part of Rodney's deal.
Right.
But I heard these demo tapes and I had never really heard anything like Guy's voice before, and I was just completely enchanted with the way him and Roger, you know, the guitar interplay. And I consider, I'm glad you're a Thin White Rope fan, because I consider those my true, like, legacy records. Mm-hmm. They didn't really sell that much, but they're just so phenomenal, and the songwriting is so profound. I mean, I felt like he was one of the best lyricists I'd ever heard, besides being such a great songwriter. But he was signed to a label called Rational that had put out some Game Theory records, so I went through hell to sign those guys. I mean, literally, like, hell on earth, like, got into a big fight with Enigma. We were having some sort of a bidding war before they finally dropped out. It was just ridiculous.
Wow.
But I won. Guy wanted to work with me, so that was, I mean, they might have had some big, huge career, they might not have, but they actually signed with the little guy or the little girl instead of Enigma. I think they just felt like such a part of a small town life. They were just weirded out by the hugeness of Enigma. They didn't even really take it that seriously, but... so that was interesting times, and we made that record out in the desert. Something affected him down in the desert. Something affected him down in the desert. With the brother, you know, Captain Antoniel?
Yes.
It was the brother of him that recorded. He was in the Surf Punks, and I think he died last year.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
God, what was his first name? Something Dragon. There's Daryl Dragon, and
I think he went by Drew Steele, right? That's what he went by.
Yeah. He would call himself Drew Steele. And then Jeff Irick was a quote unquote real producer. I'm not sure how we wound up working with him, because it just kind of wasn't a good match. That's the most I'll say. It wasn't a good match. But we made it out in Malibu. We made it really quickly. And that was another one where they just made me use the most expensive mastering guy ever. And I thought the record was very successful, I mean, sound-wise. But when my friend Paul DeGray remastered them recently, it was like peeling a layer of film off of them. It was like there's things you never heard before on the original ones.
Ooh.
I don't know what to attribute that to, but it was just like a whole... The digital remastering just really opened those up, and extremely proud of those. And then the true diehard fans that got them were very excited. So that was good.
Yeah, Paul DeGray's great. I had him master some stuff for me. So I was in his little studio in Burbank, and he has some compressors, analog compressors, that are just incredible. So the work that he was doing for me, just listening, being in that room as he's mastering and hearing those go through those analog compressors, it's like double digit, like over 10 grand for each piece of equipment that he's running it through. So I imagine that could have been what made those records just pop.
And he would bring something, I don't even know what you would call it. He would bring this thing when K-Disc mastering was in Hollywood, he would bring it and like hook it into the board, like use his gear to plug into their gear. And the mastering engineers would be like, "What is that? Can I buy it?" And he'd be like, "Nope, that's mine."
Yeah, yeah.
But total gearhead without driving you crazy, you know, boring you with it or trying to describe it to me or anything. I'd just be like, "That sounds great." But anyway, he just really gets guitar music. So thank goodness I can, you know, he's 5 minutes from my house. I'm having him master something right now. So
excellent.
He's a super good guy. So yeah,
indeed. Exactly.
Everybody loves him.
Yes, he is. Does great work, too.
Yes. Highly recommend Paul DeGray. And he'll be I already tagged him to be the sound mixer at my show at the Echo and the Echoplex, so that they'll sound good.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have a pesky little question for you. We want to know.
Really?
Yeah. What's the best-selling Frontier release?
Wait, what'd you say?
What's the best selling?
Oh, the best selling is Suicidal, definitely. Definitely. I go, "Mom, just give me a Pepsi, please. All I want is a Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. All I wanted was a Pepsi. Just one Pepsi. And she wouldn't give it to me. Just a Pepsi. Keep my shirt with my sleeves. Not ready back to see a sleeve. Just yucky, just lazy. It's a good deal. I'm crazy. I'm not crazy. Here's the future. You're the one that's crazy. Here's the future.
Wow.
And do you have a favorite release of yours?
That's like probably, I only have cats, so that's probably like asking somebody what their favorite child is. But, you know, I really think Group Sex holds up. I think everything, I wouldn't say anything I like actually hate.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some people that I wish had been discovered more, like the Shame Idols and Flop that I put out in the 90s were super good, really awesome power punk kind of bands, and Good Live too, but they just didn't quite take off. Favorite one single record, maybe Moonhead by Thin White Rope if I was forced to gunpoint.
Such a great album. Oh, that's so good.
But it's a great album, and they finished so early because they just knew what they wanted to play. They were so well rehearsed that they didn't even use up all the time they had, so I was moving residences, and they actually helped me pack up and move everything. So what a bunch of nice guys. That was a good memory after exploring the Axis, which is kind of fraught with all kinds of terrors and bad things. So
that's pretty cool. Sound like good guys.
Yeah.
So
they are super good guys. I just saw Roger. He played with Russ Tolman in a teeny tiny bar about a month and a half ago. So it was really good to see Roger again and catch up.
Very
His kid
cool.
is going to UCLA, and when I knew him, he didn't even have any kids.
Yeah.
So it's been a while.
He was a kid himself at the time.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right.
So Flop is a band that I definitely need to check out, and they've been on my list. I was at a show, I think it was Red Cross, actually, in San Diego at the mm-hmm. Casbah, and there was a group of guys outside of the show waiting for me to get in first, and they kept talking about Flop. And they were talking.
Rusty was in many, many really cool Seattle bands. Just a really great songwriter. Those records are just really fun, and the songs hold up. Kurt Block produced them, so they're, you know, super rocking. And I put out two or three records. I got signed to Sony, and then I wound up putting out the record that Sony put out. And they weren't big sellers, but they're all good, so people can, somewhere in the future, people will discover them. And the Shame Idols were from Birmingham, Alabama. And honestly, I can't remember how that came about. Like, where? Because, you know, usually I sign sort of like California bands or you know, kind of went up the coast to Portland and Seattle, but I can't remember how I came to sign those guys. Anyway, they're super nice, really solid songwriting, and nobody even knew they were out. Oh, well.
Well, there's
lots
of releases that made a, if nothing else, a huge impact in the world of music and the indie music, the punk scene. And we're just thankful for you, Lisa, thankful for Frontier Records. But we wanted to, before we let you go, we did want to have you let our listeners know how they can find Frontier Records and order some of the material.
Well, we have a URL, but our website's been down for a while because somebody will start it and not finish it or whatever. So we took down the old site and then can't put it back up, like all destroyed when people pick it apart. Anyway, if you want to buy my record, you can go on Bandcamp and just search for Frontier Records, and we have everything up there. There's many records that are not in print physically that are on digital methods like Naked Prey and things. Like, there's just no physical demand for it. So if you're really hankering for Naked Prey, or the ones that I put out, you can get it. You can download it, as they say.
Nice. So what about the future of the label? You mentioned that there were some releases coming up, and I know there is a connection with the Danger House, the records that those put out.
Yeah, I actually represent and all the Danger House, everything on Danger House is in print and on Frontier. And there's two volumes of various artists. I've never released the singles as is. Munster put out a box set of all the singles, and I distributed that over here. But the future, I'm going to do a Lily's record called Brief History of Amazing Letdowns. There's a local band that I absolutely love called the Flatworms, and I'm going to put out a live record. They're on Drag City, but oh. I'm putting out a live record. And what else is coming out? Oh, I found some unreleased Christian Death stuff.
What?
So I'm putting out a 4-song. I just ragged on EPs for not making any money. But anyway, that's all the tracks I got. So we're putting out 4 Christian Death tracks from the Only Theater of Pain era.
Ooh, that sounds very cool.
And then maybe, like I said, there's I'm talking to a couple of vintage punk bands that have a whole bunch of back catalog. So I'll either do a compilation or, you know, keep releasing things like that. So the kids, they love the punk rock, so you got to keep putting out the punk rock.
Yes, we do. Even us old folks.
Yep. Even the old timers, they want the old singles. I had to sell a lot of my stuff when I was broke, so reissuing the Stimulators and stuff is it's good. Everybody can buy things that you don't have to spend $400 on it anymore.
Thank you.
Yes.
And unless you want to, you can. You're welcome to.
I don't know, Jeff. Lisa seems to be the most punk person I think that we've talked to so far.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
from the
100%. If you saw me, you would laugh and laugh because it was so funny. Because I would go to punks, like the gnarliest of punk shows, where the cops chase us around. And all the kids outside would be like, "Ma'am, can you give me $1?" And I'd be like, "I put out the Circle Jerks. Don't call me ma'am." Laughing across your face, you idiot. But I never looked punk. Like, my era for dressing up stupid was glam. And then I just had no desire whatsoever. I never needed to have a pink mohawk or, you know what I mean? I just didn't. I just looked like a, you know how the Minutemen, they just look like people.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
Red Cross, you know, they didn't look all punk. Like, I just didn't feel any reason to dress up anymore. I was a record company executive.
It was all attitude. That's it.
That's punk right. It's all inside. The punk rock is inside, not outside.
Amazing. Lisa, this was a lot of fun for me. Jeff, I know for you too.
It was not fun for Jeff, but it was fun for you.
He got to talk about Thin White Rope.
Yes.
That's right. No, that's great because everybody, it should be like when you go to school, they should teach Thin White Rope so people know what good music is. So.
Agreed.
Good for you for bringing it up on the show.
Once again, thank you, Lisa Fancher of Frontier Records, celebrating 40 years.
Wow.
And
in the music biz, wow, is right.
Yes. Fantastic. And if you like vintage punk, you got to thank Lisa.
Yep.
You like Paisley Underground? Thank Lisa. She had definitely.
Oh,
Yeah.
I know what I need to say. I have my very own radio station, so there, it's called KXFU.net, so it's just, I'm too lazy to get ads, so it's just streaming weird stuff all the time.
Hey. So
check me out.
KXFU. Stream it.
Yeah, KXFU.net. Check it out. Yep. Awesome. I've plugged everything I can plug.
we'll continue to do the same.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me on, though.
Thank you, Lisa. We really appreciate you, everything.
All right.
Thank
All right,
you.
Have a good one.
Stay safe.
All right. You too.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
KXFU.net.
Yes. Yes.
That is cool. Because she's got pretty cool musical taste. I can only imagine what's on that radio station.
I know. I think I just recently heard about that, and I haven't had a chance to check it out. But I do want to check it out. Because, man, just this catalog alone. And some of it's so funny when she mentioned putting out the Choir Invisible. And I can only imagine that coming on the heels of Circle Jerks. Right, in Adolescence, and then you have Choir Invisible, which is, I don't know, new romantic sound. And then you got Baroque Hoedown, Suicidal Tendencies, 16 Tambourines, and...
and then Native Sons. Like, you have all these kind of moments in Frontier history, and then Red Cross.
Right.
We're like, you know, it's definitely not a one-trick pony.
No. I mean, there are, I would think, like, the connections are independent, young musicians that are on fire, putting out music that they're passionate about, different styles, but that's the only connection that I can make, is the region, the passion, the age,
yeah,
independent.
And look at how she said it, you know, like, I heard something that I liked, and I said, I want to put that out. Even if I, you know, imagine her bringing something first to Greg Shaw, and Greg Shaw going, and then she goes, well, I'm going to take my pennies, and I'm going to release it.
Yes. Nice.
That's a baller attitude.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes, me too.
But she's got a great ear and then a good approach for approaching artists, because when she, was it the Shame Idol she was talking about? No, the issue with Enigma, where Frontier wins.
Oh, that was a thin.
I was taking notes, and now I have like lines and arrows.
That was the thin like, white rope issue.
Thin white rope.
Yeah.
And she goes, you know, can you imagine going toe to toe with Enigma
and
walking out with that contract? I mean, she's got something not just in terms of her ear, her appreciation for good music, but also, you know, she's got a ton of drive.
Yep.
And, you know, she's tenacious. I like it.
Me too.
She's punk rock.
Very much so. You're right. I think probably the most punk rock person that we've had on the show, other than Joe Nulty, maybe.
Oh, well, yeah. We can always have co-winners.
Yes, indeed. Lisa, yeah, I'm so thankful that we finally got around to having Lisa on the show. Learned a lot about some of my favorite releases. You know, I have a few albums in my collection, and then there's
just a smidge,
yeah,
just a little bit,
and there's actually quite a few records from Frontier that are in my personal collection, the ones that we've talked about today, and quite a few others that fall outside of our normal discussion. So,
you know what I can appreciate about Frontier is you know, it's sad, but also, you know, it's definitely it speaks to the current moment that we're living in. You know, she says, you know, some of these we can't have a vinyl copy, you know, due to, you know, the supply of vinyl and, you know, that sort of thing. But the fact that she's been able to put a lot of things digitally and she can still release it can still be streamed or downloaded. I mean, that's important too, because like she said, you can still hear that vintage punk rock. And, you know, I love the fact that she said, even when things are remastered, that they can still find new sound, or, you know, she said it was like peeling away layers.
Yep.
And then find and unearthing new sound. So I just like that she appreciates good music and is willing to put some time and effort behind it. It's just, I don't know, She seems like a really cool lady.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But this was a great thing. And also, just a reminder, folks. So, KXFU.net, if you want to hear Lisa Fancher's radio station. Also, Frontier Catalog is available on Bandcamp. Bandcamp is probably your best way to have more contact with her and the catalog. And fun stuff coming out.
Yes, and it sounds like there may be some live shows if we get back to a point where those are happening. And those sound like some pretty amazing shows to attend. I want to do the non-punk one and the punk one. I want to go to both of those.
Perfect. I'm down.
All right, Soraya.
All right, gente. Ahora we are.
Groove on, Paisley people.
Galaxy.